This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Hello, we're going to talk about the Supreme Court here, and we have with us the foremost expert in Arizona on the Supreme Court, ASU Professor Paul Bender. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, for those of you who are not familiar with Paul Bender, he has been very close to the Supreme Court, and I think I'm doing this from memory, but I think the title you held at one point was chief, principal deputy solicitor general, which
there you go,
which is like basically the solicitor general. If the United States of America takes a case to the Supreme Court, that's argued by the solicitor general. You were the number two guy in that office. Is that a fair?
Yeah, all federal government litigation in the Supreme Court is handled by the Solicitor General's office. It's a small office of very, very good lawyers. And they get to argue in the Supreme Court and write briefs and stuff like that.
So it's familiar territory to you, which is,
yes, it is.
Perfect for
I've
this.
I've argued there, I think, 20 times, 25 times, I forget.
So we want to start out with a review because we didn't have you on last year. And what we're going to do here is talk about the cases that the court decided last year in the first half of the show. And then more or less in the second half of the show, we'll go into cases that are up. The court is in session now in the month of October. And so we have pretty much a good idea what will be before the Supreme Court this year.
You get about half, at this time we know about half the cases they're going to hear this year.
Well, we will talk about those in the third and fourth segment here, but I want to start with a review. And the first issue that I wanted to ask you about, there was a case that dealt with political gerrymandering. And just in case anybody needs to be brought up to speed, gerrymandering typically occurs when one party is in control of the process in a state and they draw the lines in a way to try to pack all their opponents in as few districts as possible so that they can control the majority of the districts.
Yeah, by drawing the lines, if you have freedom to draw the lines, the district lines, you can up your representation of your party in the state legislature very substantially. We've had cases where a party with like 45% of the votes got 65% of the legislature. The way you do that is, as you say, you put the other party, you pack them into a few districts so they win those, but you win all the others.
And usually you will lose a small number of districts really big and win a lot of close races. The most extreme examples in recent memory of this are the Republicans did this in Michigan and North Carolina. The Democrats did it in Maryland, and those all figured in recent cases.
Wisconsin was also a place where the Republicans have done it recently. So it's a very well-known tactic, and when you have legislatures drawing districts, the natural thing for them to do, the first thing legislators do when they draw districts is make sure they have a safe seat.
For themselves.
For themselves,
yeah,
right.
Self-preservation is number one. Then we worry
exactly.
About our
and
party.
And then they preserve their party by trying to maximize their party's representation. You have to make a guess. How much of a safe majority do you want? But you can pretty well, especially these days when we have all kinds of computer aids in this process, finding out what people are going to vote, how people are going to vote, you can really substantially up your party's representation in the state legislature. And you can do the same thing with the congressional delegation. Arizona has 9 now congressional seats. If I could draw those lines, I could probably get the Republicans one more seat than their number of votes would indicate. Or if I'm a Democrat, I could get the Democrats 1 or 2 more seats.
And I think there's a hidden point in what you make that is really what's different. This has been going on since the Republic was founded. But what has happened is the technology for how to do it, the data that is available is so much more powerful, and you can do it to greater and greater effect than they could do 50 or 100
Absolutely.
Years ago.
And so, a lot of people just are experts in doing this, and they rent themselves out to the parties. So it is a scandal, I think, and I think almost everybody thinks it's a scandal. For example, there have been several recent years when there were, I don't know, about 2 million more votes for Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives, but the Republicans had the majority of people in the House, and that's all because of gerrymandering.
It's not an accident. What that says is in the after the last census, the Republicans tended to control the process.
Right. And it, traditionally, legislatures did districting. But recently, because people have been upset about the fact that legislators think of themselves first and their party second, there's been a movement to change that and have people other than legislatures do the redistricting. Arizona has been at the forefront of that. We have an independent redistricting commission that the people adopted. The legislature hates it. And it is supposed to draw districts not on partisan lines. And in fact, our Constitution says the various factors they're supposed to use. And that has been somewhat successful in Arizona. It's not as successful as it could be. Nothing ever is. One of the problems with the Arizona system is that the legislators pick the members of the commission. They're evenly divided by Democrats and Republicans. And then the four people they pick a chairperson. The chairperson has a tremendous amount of power because he's the only neutral person there. And the legislators have had a lot of power in picking the four other people that are on the commission. And so those people tend to think more politically than you would like them to. What you really want is a commission which is totally non-political.
So let's move on to the Supreme Court. Last year, the Supreme Court took on a case that dealt with gerrymandering. What did they do?
They did something really, really important. They decided that they would no longer decide cases challenging the constitutionality of districts because they were politically gerrymandered. They said political gerrymandering may be unconstitutional, but it's a political question, which they are not going to decide. They have been struggling to find a standard, a rule about political gerrymandering for the last 20 years. And they've come very close, but they've been 5-4 cases which have said, we don't know how to do this, so we're not going to do it this case. It looked like they were about to finally decide what the rule was about what kind of political gerrymandering was unconstitutional, because Kennedy, in his last term on the court, wrote an opinion saying he really wanted to do something about this and was hoping that litigants would provide the court with a way of finding a rule that would outlaw extreme political gerrymandering. Then he resigned from the court. And so now he's not there anymore, and you have five people on the court who, the four conservatives, have regularly voted against finding political gerrymandering unconstitutional. And now with five of them on the court, they adopted an opinion which says, we will never do that. We will never decide that political gerrymandering is unconstitutional. That's a political question, and we're not going to enter that arena. That is an extraordinary thing for the Supreme Court to do. It's a constitutional problem. It's a real problem for democracy because you have minorities getting control of legislatures. They all recognize that, but they said it's not a problem they can deal with.
And the thing that I remember when that was in process, it looked like what was influencing Kennedy was he said, I can't find a measure for this. And a statistician came up with a pretty good measure, a statistical measure to measure the degree of disproportionate representation. And I think a lot of us thought that that might have held sway. But with him off
right.
the court,
a lot of people did think that. And I think it came very close. But Kennedy, and I'm not criticizing him for this, because although a statistician came up with something, it was not by any means a perfect thing. I think the problem is that the court has posed itself the wrong question. The court has said political gerrymandering is inevitable because politicians are doing it. Therefore, the question is, did they do it too much? And we have to find a standard of how much political gerrymandering is too much. When you do that, you make it impossible, because there's no way objectively you can say this is too much and this is not too much. With one person, one vote, which is the other big rule.
That's an easy standard.
That's easy because it's mathematical, and they've been able to do that pretty well. Here, there's nothing like that. The problem is that they start with the wrong assumption. They should say political gerrymandering, like racial gerrymandering, is presumptively unconstitutional. And if you want to do any of it, is presumptively unconstitutional. If you want to do it, just like racial gerrymandering, you have to have a compelling governmental interest, which is not a political interest. It's a governmental interest about the whole government, not just one party.
For example,
if you don't
keeping
have a compelling interest, then if you are drawing district lines because of politics, if you're drawing district lines in order to enhance your party's representation, that's unconstitutional. And so what you have to do is see whether that's the purpose, and if it is the purpose, then decide whether they have a compelling interest to justify it. You could do that pretty easily up until now because legislatures have been very open when they're gerrymandering in order to help themselves. In both the two cases last term that the court had, one the Democrats gerrymandered, the other Republicans gerrymandered, they were both completely open about what they were doing. So if you held that if you have a purpose of political gerrymandering, that's unconstitutional, they would stop doing that. But you can still tell whether they do it or not, just like you can tell whether people are racially discriminating without them saying that they're racially discriminating, or discriminating against women without them saying it. That's what the court had to do. And it would be a little bit subjective. Lower courts would have to decide, were they really trying to enhance their power by gerrymandering or not? Sometimes you can tell for sure, sometimes you can't. If you find that they were doing that, did they have a really good reason to do it? It's like all the other kinds of constitutional litigation we have. Free speech is not an absolute right. If you can interfere with free speech, you have a good enough reason. So you could hold that political gerrymandering is not an absolute wrong if you have a good enough reason to do it. But if all you're doing is trying to enhance your party's political representation at the expense of the other party, that's unconstitutional. It's anti-democratic. Democracy says majority wins. And if you interfere with that by drawing the district lines to try to make the majority not win and the minority win, that's unconstitutional unless you have a really good reason for doing it.
We'll be back with Paul Bender in just a moment talking about all things Supreme Court.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back with Paul Bender. We're discussing recent Supreme Court cases of this past term. One of them that caught my eye professionally was the question of asking the citizenship question on the census. And as somebody who does surveys for a living, I have to weigh in just on the facts of the matter, which were largely in dispute. It's not necessary from the standpoint of data collection. The census asked this question in numerous other surveys, and it's quite evident from the evidence that the purpose of this was to suppress the participation in the census, which would have the effect of suppressing the count of Hispanics in various places, including Arizona. Is that a fair statement?
The court said they couldn't do it in the way they were doing it. It's a remarkable case, and it tells you, I think, something about Chief Justice Roberts. The court held in that case that the Department of Commerce could not put this question on the census, even though they'd done it in the past, and there are a lot of legitimate reasons why you'd want to do it, because they gave an illegitimate reason. They lied about what they were doing. The court said that openly. And you're not telling us the truth.
They found it in documents. There was a consultant involved who died, and they got his documents, and he had suggested to the Justice Department, if we do this, it'll suppress the Hispanic count, which you want.
Right, and that's a bad reason for doing it, and that's the reason that they gave. The reason that they gave was they were doing it to enforce the Voting Rights Act. And that was phony. And the Supreme Court of the United States, in an opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, a 5-4 opinion, said, you've given us a phony reason, and we're not going to let you get away with it. But the you there is a department of the United States government. It's a cabinet officer. The court has not done that very often, if ever, to say to a cabinet department, you had a good reason to do it, but you gave a bad reason, and we know you're lying to us, and therefore we're not going to let you do it, even though there are good reasons you could do it. I think that's the right thing for the court to do, but it's a remarkable thing for this court to do with a Republican administration and a Republican dominated court to say that they would look behind what Republican cabinet officials did and say, we don't think you're telling us the truth, and so we're not going to let you do it.
Well, they found a smoking gun in this case, I think, was the court's problem, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, there were a lot of smoking guns. To me, the main smoking gun was the reason they gave was completely phony. There is no reason why you needed to ask a citizenship question to help you enforce the Voting Rights Act. You had that information from a lot of other places.
The census has something called the American Community Survey, which is done every month. It amounts to millions over the course of a year. And those kinds of data are the data that are regularly used for all of those purposes. The census
right.
is strictly...
You know that a lot better than I do. And the court said, hey, you don't need to do it for the reason you're given. And in the background, there's the problem that if what you're really doing is racially discriminatory. So for the court, for this court to recognize that the effect of something is racially discriminatory, even though a good reason is given, and say, we don't trust your good reason, we think you're lying to us, that's a remarkable thing for the court to do. That's really assertion of the court's power over the government in a way that they very rarely do. And to have the Chief Justice do that, open people's eyes to say, hey, maybe this Chief Justice is really not bound to the Republican Party. He's not bound to the conservative side. He has an open mind on some things. And it indicates that he might. And so the big question before the court, from most people's point of view, but the court generally, is what's happening on the court? Is the Chief Justice coming to be a middle vote? A swing vote the way Kennedy was? Or is this just something that will happen every once in a while, but in fact he's going to be a reliable conservative vote? And his opinion in the census case opened the question of whether he might be more flexible than he had seemed to be.
Okay, we'll pick this up in just a moment. My reaction is, if there is a swing vote, it's got to be him. And but it's swing. The fulcrum is a little bit further to the right, but somebody's going to be in the middle when you have nine people on the court. It's Roberts, for better or worse. We'll be back with Paul Bender in just a moment.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back with Paul Bender, and we're talking about all things Supreme Court. The first thing I want to ask you about isn't something that is up in front of the Supreme Court yet, but it seems almost destined to. And this last week, there was a district court case in federal court having to do with Harvard's admissions policies with respect to affirmative action. I wonder if you could discuss that, maybe even in the context of affirmative action cases going back to Bakke, which is like from the 1970s. The court has kind of thread a needle on the whole affirmative action issue, hasn't it?
Race-conscious affirmative action in education and other places has been a problem the Supreme Court has had for a long time, whether that is constitutional or not, whether it's constitutional to take race into account to, for example, with the universities, to try to get a diverse class, to get a university class that's more representative of the population of the state. Is that constitutional? And the court has walked a very, very hard-to-find line. They've said it is not, it's sort of what I was saying before about political gerrymandering. Presumptively, you can't use race, but you can if you have a really good reason. And the reason that the court has identified, in the educational area anyway, is diversity of the population, of the student body, and I think also of the faculty. That's a strong enough one, and that was proposed first by Justice Powell in the Bakke case a long time ago, who said, you know, it's a really important thing to have a diverse class because it's important for the educational process. You can't really learn about things unless you have a diversity of opinion. So now the question of race-conscious affirmative action is if you can justify it by diversity. The Harvard case, I think, is quite different from that. I think what's going on there is people who don't like affirmative action have been looking for years for a way to change the rule and do what the conservatives wanted to do in the first place, is say, you can't do race-conscious affirmative action at all. Forget about diversity, forget about compelling interests. You just can't do it at all. And they were trying to use the Harvard case, which uses race. It's really negative action is what Harvard has been doing, I think, and it is if they didn't do something, if they just used their normal admissions criteria, the class would have a very large percentage of Asians in it. And Harvard, it is said, was worried about that and therefore introduced into their admissions process things that were contrary to Asians in order to keep the numbers down. And that was attacked, I think, by people who wanted to end race-conscious affirmative action for a completely different reason, that is to stop Harvard from using it to diversify the class, to have more minorities in it. And they thought this would be a way to stop all of it by saying you can't use race in order to lessen the number of Asians. The court said they're not doing that. They're not lessening the number of Asians. And besides which, race-conscious affirmative action is okay if it's done for diversity. So the district court left the law exactly where it was before, but that will be appealed to probably a court of appeals and then to the Supreme Court. And so this is a case which may give the conservative majority on the Supreme Court ultimately the power to go back to what they wanted to do in the first place, which was say you can't use race at all in university admissions.
One of the interesting things about that in terms of the argument is that the plaintiffs had to argue that they were suppressing the number of Asians, which currently I believe at Harvard is about 30% compared to about 3% of the population. They're arguing that that if you took race out as a factor, the number would have even been higher.
That's what people suspect, and they thought that Harvard was trying to make sure. Does this ring a bell to you of something that has happened in the past? There was a time in the past when Harvard thought there were too many Jews in the class.
Absolutely. Absolutely in the history. Yep.
And they put a quota on Jews, and there was the courts didn't enter that. They weren't in the business of doing that then, but there's a lot of revulsion for that, and Harvard stopped doing that. Now they're doing the same thing. Hey, we have too many Asians. That really bothers me. And it bothers me that Harvard is trying to defend that. If they have the admission system that is the one they think picks the best people, it doesn't matter whether it turns up a lot of Asians or few Asians. It shouldn't matter from their point of view, unless it turns up so few that there's no diversity. If you get enough of the different groups in your society to have a decent representation in the class, that's all you should want to have. You shouldn't say, hey, we got too many Italians, too many this, too many that. That's exactly the wrong thing for a university to do. And it looked here that that's what they were doing with Asians, saying we have too many of them and trying to stop that. That's negative action, not affirmative action.
Sounds to me like that's part of an appellate brief on this case.
Right. It will be.
And the thing about university admissions is it's never complete. This is not a pure thing to begin with, in that you have all kinds of special categories. You have legacy. If you're a son or daughter of a Harvard alumnus, you do a little bit better. If you're an athlete, you do a little bit better. If you're somebody who's a donor prospect, you do a little bit better. None of those things are absolute, but they're all factors.
Right, and they all affect the diversity of a class, a lot of them in a negative way, and yet they do that for their own reasons. And so it seems a little hypocritical for them when they're doing that many things that are anti-educational, anti-diversity, anti-fair, to come along and say, yeah, we need to do this for the purposes of fairness. So the universities who have legacies and who have athletic scholarships and have donor scholarships and things like that, faculty members, children get a boost also. Mm-hmm. If they have all those kinds of boosts, it's a little hard to come along and say, we can't do that because we're not allowed to alter the system, because they alter the system all the time.
Now, have the courts distinguished in these affirmative action cases between public and private universities? I know that's been advanced as an argument.
Well, yeah, they do, because the constitutional rule of racial discrimination rules only applies to governments. Private universities are constitutionally entitled to discriminate however they want. There may be some statutes that limit them, but private universities are much freer to use whatever criteria they want in admissions because they're not governed by the Constitution.
They just argue we're a private institution. Of course, taken to its extreme, that argument was used for pro-housing discrimination. I own this house. I can rent to whoever I want as well.
Yeah, and legislatures can come along and pass legislation and limit your right to discriminate in selling or renting housing. And legislatures can come along and limit private universities in their ability to use race or other factors in their admissions. But there isn't very much of that that's happened. The rules have mostly been constitutional rules, the rules against race-conscious affirmative action, and those rules don't apply to private universities. If the private university is getting a lot of federal money, then they may be limited because there's a federal statute that says if you get federal money, then you have to do what we make state universities do.
Well, if you get
private
federal...
universities are willing to do it on their own, they're really very free to do whatever they want.
There are almost no institutions left that don't get federal money, though.
Okay. Well, then they would be, but not on the theory that they're unconstitutional when they do it, but on the theory that there are federal statutes which limit that. And those federal statutes are up to Congress. They can change them anytime they want. And so I think private universities have much more possibility of using race or other factors in admissions because the statutory rules are really not as tight, and the statutory rules are always open to being changed.
Now, I'm thinking back to the whole, not just this case, but to the whole drift of affirmative action cases. Have the courts also made a distinction where they've either outlawed or virtually outlawed absolute quotas, but have ruled
yes.
that you may consider race as a factor among many? Is that a fair statement of the state of the law now?
Yeah, that was Justice Powell's view in the Bakke case. He was writing only for himself. The other eight people were divided. But that's become the court's general approach. You can't have strict quotas. You can't say we're going to take 25% of the class is going to be black people because the population of the state is 25% black. That's unconstitutional. But you can say we're going to use it as a factor, and we're going to use it to try to get diversity. And as long as you stay away from strict numbers, and as long as you stay away from we're trying to mirror the population of the state, the court said you can't do that. But you can use race or other factors in order to get a diverse student body for educational purposes. That's very squishy, very hard to police. There are no really firm rules there. And so that's the way the law has been. And so you can have race-conscious affirmative action in some situations if you make a good case that you need it in order to have a diverse class.
I mean, that's one of the interesting byproducts of the Harvard admissions case. A whole lot of stuff came out about the admission rates for a wide variety of groups that, you know, some of which are easier to justify than others. The legacy percentage, for example, that number was way higher than I think than the university wanted to admit to.
Yeah, but if it's okay to take in children of graduates for whatever reasons the government has, it should be, in my view, okay to have taken people in order to make sure that certain groups are represented in your university population. And I would think it would be okay to make sure they're represented in roughly the percentage they have in the population. That if you have a university to serve the whole population, the groups in the population ought to have significant representation, more or less the same as their representation in the population. I would think that would be a legitimate thing also. And the court has said it is legitimate if you're doing it to get a diverse class for your educational purposes. It's not legitimate if you're just trying to mirror the state's population. That's never made any sense to me, but at least it's opened the way for schools to have significant. For example, at the law school, if we didn't take things into account, we wouldn't have very, very few Hispanics in the class, for example.
And you could argue, is the Hispanic community being well served by the legal profession?
Yeah, and it's important because, you know, judges, for example, decide things in part according to how they grew up in the community they grew up in, and judges come from lawyers, and you want to have the law profession diverse. There are lots of good reasons for doing that. What's happening in the Harvard case is that the people who brought that case are trying to dismantle that system, and they try to seize on the Harvard situation because Harvard was pretty clearly using race to keep down the number of Asians, and they said, see, that's unconstitutional, and so you have to outlaw all race-conscious stuff so you can't give a boost to racial minorities. And the court said, no, Harvard's not doing that. And besides which, it's okay to give a boost to racial minorities if you're trying to diversify.
And
the
problem, of course, is that it's a zero-sum thing. You may not necessarily be trying to keep down the number of Hispanics, but if you're trying to increase the percentage of blacks and others, it's zero-sum. Ultimately, if somebody is going to be overrepresented, somebody's going to be underrepresented.
Yeah, and they're trying to make the case in the Harvard case that by taking in a lot of Asians, you would be decreasing the number of blacks, for example, and Hispanics you're taking, because, as you say, it's a zero-sum game. So it's part of a campaign. The people who brought that case have been bringing litigation all over the country for years to try to get the court finally to totally outlaw race-conscious admissions and go back to the old system, where you had universities dominated by a race, usually white race, when the whites were not that big a majority in the community at all. And we had law that was formulated by white judges and white lawyers over many, many years. And they want to say that you can't use race as a way of trying to change that and give racial minorities a significant say in what happens in the community by giving them a significant part of the population of the universities.
We could clearly do a whole show just on affirmative action, but we're going to move on when we return in just a moment, talk about some of the other cases that are up in front of the Supreme Court this term. We'll be back with Paul Bender in just a moment.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back with Supreme Court expert Paul Bender and talking about cases in front of the Supreme Court this term. You think that probably the most significant case is one that involves Title VII and the prohibition against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and against transgender people. Three cases. Wonder if you could tell us what's at stake there.
Yeah, there are three cases before the court on those two issues. The Title VII of the federal law in this area says that you can't discriminate against, in employment, this is employment that affects interstate commerce, you can't discriminate because of race, color, religion, and national origin and sex. And the question in two of these cases is, if you discriminate against people because they are homosexual, because of their sexual orientation, is that prohibited by the law that says you can't discriminate on the basis of sex? And the court's going to have to decide that. The other case before them is a case where they discriminated against somebody because he was transsexual. And the same question there is, if you discriminate against somebody because they're transsexual, is that a discrimination on the grounds of sex? The problem is that you can't tell from the words of the statute alone whether they apply. When you say you can't discriminate on grounds of sex, you would think that what they were talking about, you can't treat people differently if they're a man or a woman. But it could also mean you can't treat people differently because they're homosexual or heterosexual. And you can't tell from the words alone, I think, what it means. And so then you have to go into, well, how are you going to interpret it? If you interpret it according to what the framers of that language years ago, 1964, thought, they probably were not thinking about discrimination against homosexuals. They didn't think they were stopping that by that legislation. But if you think about it today, the same reasons for stopping discrimination against men or women are probably applicable to discrimination against people because they're homosexual rather than heterosexual. So if you treat it functionally as to whether, hey, this is like the other discriminations you're prohibiting, discrimination between men and women, discrimination on grounds of religion, discrimination on grounds of national origin, discrimination on grounds of sexual orientation is very similar to that because it's something you can't do anything about. It's part of your personality. It's part of your life. But if you go back to what were the framers thinking, the framers of this language, they probably weren't thinking about that. So it really highlights the debate that people think about all the time in interpretation of the Constitution and statutes, originalism. Do you do it the way the people who drafted it what they thought it meant at that time? Or do you take what the general purpose they were trying to achieve was and try to interpret their language in accordance with that general purpose?
If the former, then this is where we get into these arguments that say, well, the judges are legislating from the bench.
Well, yeah, they say that, but the judges are not legislating from the bench. The judges are trying to decide what a statute means. And when it's not 100% clear what the statute means from its language, which it rarely is, you have to try to decide what that language means. And that's a decision not legislating from the bench. It's trying to figure out what the people who wrote that statute were trying to do. Were they trying to establish a principle of there's certain kinds of discrimination which you can't use in employment, discrimination against people who are minorities, who've been historically discriminated against, and who can't do anything about it. It's part of themselves. If that's what they were trying to do, then you might try to take that purpose and apply it in the case before you. So I think that what you should be doing is trying to figure out what that communication from Congress means. That's not legislating from the bench. That's trying to figure out what Congress was doing. Those are two different things.
It seems to me that's an issue that comes up in a lot of these cases where you can,
yes.
Where you can say, I mean, in 1789, nobody was questioning slavery, but then we have non-discrimination laws that basically, if you look at the way the principle is espoused, it clearly fits with that. But even though they weren't literally thinking about that at the time.
Well, a good example of that is the 14th Amendment itself with regard to race and gender discrimination. The 14th Amendment was drafted because of race discrimination, and that was the main thing it was aimed at. But the court has since that time developed the principle that if you discriminate on grounds of gender, that's more or less just as bad as discriminating on grounds of race, even though I think at the time that language was drafted for the 14th Amendment, the framers weren't thinking about that. But they used general language, and the court has used that general language to formulate a principle that goes beyond what was in the people's minds at the time they drafted the language.
And clearly at that point they weren't, because when the 14th Amendment was adopted, we didn't allow women to vote, and that didn't give women the vote, but it's not hard to see that principle being consistent with the intent. And
right. The world has changed, and the court has taken that into account, figuring that the people who drafted this did not mean to make it static in time. They meant to enact a principle, not a solution to particular problems.
That's the last word. Thank you very much, Paul Bender. Thank you for your participation, and we'll watch the Supreme Court hopefully have you back at the end of the year, maybe to tell us what happened with some of these other things, as well as cases we didn't get to when we return next week in the Think Tank.